I'd like to welcome Marcus Hartley with Northern Economics, and he's going to give us a monitoring report. Marcus, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the council. My name is Marcus Hartley. I'm a consultant from Alaska, Northern Economics, the name of the company. I've been a fisheries economist for 23 years. I started out with the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, worked as their senior economist through 1997, and then started working with Northern Economics. Before I joined the council, I was in graduate school, and then before that, I was actually a fishery observer out in the early days of the fishery in Alaska. So, if you don't mind, I'll just work through these slides. The chairman has told me that we've got about 20 minutes, and so I'll probably work through these fairly quickly. I think you've all got copies of the slides in front of you. Quick overview of our document. The document that we've prepared, I believe, has also been distributed to you. It's 95 pages long. We break the document into six sections: an introduction, a review of programs in the Northeast, then a review of programs on the West Coast, followed by a review of programs in Alaska, and then a comparison. And we also have a list of persons contacted. We did a lot of interviews in New England with fishermen, with buyers, dealers, with members of the staff, as well as folks in Oregon and Washington and the West Coast, and talked to quite a few people in Alaska as well. I didn't realize it was coming in like this, but there you go. Part of the project goals are that we're evaluating the goals and objectives of the performance of the dockside monitoring program in the New England fisheries. The project is sponsored by Environmental Defense Fund with coordination from GMRI and members of the working group. And we're going to also compare programs in the West Coast and Alaska to the New England fishery, finally trying to understand why and how the cost differences arise between the various programs, and to look at ways that in the New England multi-species fisheries, the costs of observers and monitors there might be mitigated. This slide talks about the importance of fishery monitoring. Go into some detail here about the monitoring is one of the cornerstones of improvement in the fisheries, and if we have a good monitoring system, then we can avoid overharvests, enable maybe higher ACLs, get more precision, and so forth. Throughout the presentation, I use several acronyms. I use ASMs for at-sea monitors, DSMs for dockside monitors. I use the acronym NEFOP for the program, the New England Fishery Observer Program, and then NEFO as an observer from NEFOP. This NEMSF is the Northeast Multispecies Fishery. The PTNS is, of course, the pre-trip notification system, and the SBRM is the standard bycatch reporting methodology. This slide shows trip coverage levels by trip in 2010. This is data from September, and the average, as you can see here, is 33%, but there's quite a lot of variation between sectors. These are all the sector names. And this is based on data that was provided from the Observer Program from Amy Van Atten. You can see some of the variability here, 29% in some, up to 45% in other sectors. This is the combined NEFO plus ASM trip-by-trip coverage. There were some corrections to the data. We had been working for quite some time with data that was published in July. The July data in this slide is represented by the blue bars. The red bars, and then the data that we received in September is represented by the blue bars. And you can see that the data in September pushed the overall coverage up considerably. And we haven't really quite figured out exactly how those differences in data, where they came from, but believe that it probably had something to do with numbers of trips that might have been double counted or trips that were inappropriately attributed to sector trips. But that did have the effect to raise the overall catch, the observer level on trips. This slide looks at the various differences in C-Day coverage, the NEFO coverage. There were 25,000 C-Days in the sector fisheries in 2010. We had 1,900 NEFO days, 6,148 ASM days, combining for 8,136 days. And then the third column here is the average over all the sectors, 7.9% for ASMs, 24.4 for ASMs, 7.9 for NEFOs. But then we also show here the range by sectors, and you can see that the range was pretty significant. For example, ASMs, the lowest sector, had only 2.5% coverage of days, and then the highest sector had 39.1%. So there's quite a lot of variability in the coverage levels. And we looked at that, looking at chi-square tests to see if the overall coverage level was equal across sectors. If you a chi-square test says, if everything is supposed to have equal coverage, say at 33%, then there's a limit that that you would expect to see if the sample is drawn from a random sample. And we basically looked at those numbers and said, well, it's about there's about 185 chances per million that the sample of coverage that we're seeing there could have been a random distribution around 33% coverage levels. Now, part of that is probably due to the fact that, first of all, we assume that we state here that it isn't equal across the sectors, but the fisheries, the NEFC's fishery sampling board or bureau, their goals in setting coverage levels are really kind of based on the SBRM coefficients of variation requirements by each gear and stratum. And so there is definitely this conflict. If you want fish to be sampled by appropriate gear and stratum levels or gear and area stratums, then you may not be able to get equal coverage across the board. And that may be one of the issues that we're seeing here. Now get into some of the providers, the ASM providers, and some of the cost estimates. There were three ASM providers in New England last year, AIS, East West Technical Services, and MRAG. Currently, the ASM are all using a federal contract, and they have to follow the provisions of the Fair Labor Standards Act and the Service Contract Act. And those acts set minimum wages that they have to follow, benefit requirements that they have to do. So in 2010, the C-Day costs by provider ranged from $585 to $650, with the average, according to Ms. Van Atten, the average was $630 per day. And that's just for the C-Day coverage. There is also extra travel costs, and those averaged out to $32 per day. And training reimbursements. Providers were reimbursed by NIMS for the wages and per diem costs that the trainees incurred, and that kind of averages out to $37 per day. So the total costs per C day in the shaded line here, the ASM cost was about $719 per C day. Again, these are estimates based on the information that were provided to us. And for NEFO coverage, it was quite a bit higher at $896. If you go in and calculate NIMS's overhead costs, those numbers are generally higher, $217 higher for ASMs and about $500 higher for $600 higher for NEFO. Those additional costs would probably never be charged to the program, the individual fishermen, but those are included here just for reference purposes. If we look at ASM costs here and we compare them to revenues, and again, when we talk about revenues, it's important to point out that these are revenues from ground fish in the Northeast Multispecies Program. They're the revenues that are received in the sector fisheries themselves and don't include revenues from monkfish or skates or any other of the non-multispecies stocks that may be harvested while fishing in the sectors. We didn't have good estimates of ex-vessel revenue, but we did have good numbers on sectors, ACEs, on transfers, and we combined those numbers with industry-wide exploitation rates, industry-wide discard rates, and industry-wide ex-vessel prices to come up with an overall estimate of ex-vessel value for each of the sectors. There's no doubt that those actual estimates are not 100% accurate. If you had the actual data, you could do a lot better job, but we didn't have that, so we made some estimates of it. Total of $80.5 million in the New England multi-species fishery was generated by sector vessels in 2010, and we estimated the overall cost of ASM coverage at $700 per sea day was $4.3 million. So, in other words, about 5.3% of the ex-vessel revenues from the multi-species fishery. This graph here shows the bars represent the number of sectors in each of these different percentages of ex-vessel revenues. I'm kind of colorblind, but the bluer shaded bars are the actual ASM costs as a percent of ex-vessel revenue. And there was one sector that had less than from 0 to 2% ex-vessel revenue, and then the next sectors there were five that had from 2 to 4%, and so on. One of the sectors had ASM costs that were greater than 12% of their multi-species revenue. The second set of bars in there is what we projected the costs of ASM coverage would be if, as had been recently announced, the coverage in 2012 would be 17%, and so we just ran a test and said, if 17% of the trips were covered, what would the distributions look like applied back to 2010 ex-vessel revenues? And you can see that middle set of bars is condensed quite a bit, and looks like it'll be around between 4 and 8%. We also took a look at each of the individual sectors and generated estimates of the number of days per trip that they had on average. And again, these are estimates that we were able to come up with. These are not official numbers that show the actual numbers per day, but rather we inferred these numbers from tables that we had received about trips and sea days and numbers of trips and numbers of sea days. There were six sectors had trips between greater than 1 and less than 1.5. There were four sectors in class 2 here that had trips between 1.5 and 3 days. There were also three sectors that had trips between 4.5 and 5 days. And then finally out to the right, three groups of sectors. Three classes of sectors that had trips between 5.5 and 8.5 days. In this table, we take those classes that we talked about and show what the average ASM cost for each of the classes were compared to their multi-species revenue. And again, it's just multi-species revenue. There isn't monkfish or skates or anything else in there. And we found that in class one, in class one here, again, six sectors, that their revenues were about their ASM costs were about 9.9% of their revenues. And these were the classes that had trips that were generally between 1 day and 1.5 days. If you go down to class two, see if my line is not working anymore. The second row there, class two, slightly longer trips, revenues were 5.2, or costs were 5.2% of revenues in that case. And then in the larger, the sectors that had longer trips from 4.5 to even 8.5 days, ASM costs were about 4.1% of revenue. So there is some disparity there among the different classes, and it seems to vary. It looks very clearly like it varies by the number of trips or the number of days per trip. Well, anyway, we also looked at the North Pacific program in Alaska, and I'll just quickly run through this. The program in Alaska has relatively low observer costs, right now $323 per sea day plus some travel. But in the program up in Alaska, 82% of the 39,000 trips are deployed on catcher processors or very large catcher vessels in the lucrative Bering Sea pollock fishery. Those boats all have 100% coverage, and most of those deployments of observers, many of them are weeks long at a time. And if they're not week long at a time, the observer is assigned to a vessel and stays with that vessel. They come in, they make a delivery, they go out in a couple days, it's the same observer again that goes out with it. So in those cases, there's very little involvement with the provider. Reassigning observers is not much of an issue, and so they can keep their costs quite low in that program. The remaining 18% of the vessels or of observer days were on vessels between 60 and 125 feet, and there's no coverage right now on vessels that are smaller than 60 feet. In an effort to change up their program, because they recognized some of the difficulties that they were having getting reasonable data from the vessels that were less than 125 feet, that had less than 100% coverage, they've restructured their program. It's been approved by the council. It hasn't yet been implemented or actually improved by National Marine Fisheries Service. But in that restructured program, the vessels that are currently paying or currently have 100% coverage will continue to have 100% or more coverage in some case. But the vessels that are less than 125 feet that did not have 100% coverage would be part of this restructured program. And in that program, basically it's a percentage fee of X vessel value. All of the vessels in that program will pay 0.6.25% of their X vessel revenue into a program that will fund the processing or the observer program. All of the buyers, the processors, the plants, they will also put in 0.625% of their X vessel payments that they're making to vessels into that program. And so the total will end up being 1.25% of X vessel revenue that will be funding the observer program. NIMS will deploy the observers on these vessels that are less than 125 feet that don't have 100% coverage. They'll deploy them to the vessels and into the fisheries that they think are most important to have observers. If, for example, if they're having a problem with salmon bycatch in a certain fishery in the Gulf of Alaska, they'll put more observers in them, in that fishery, than they will in other fisheries. So they'll be able to tailor their coverage on these vessels to the degree that they want to. A little bit more about this program. the fact that fees are a percent of revenue ensure that costs are spread equitably across all of the participating vessels, whether or not they're actually getting coverage. You have to pay your fee even if you're never an observer never sets foot on your boat for the entire year. You still have to pay that fee. And then NIMS is able to maximize the benefits from coverage by focusing the coverage on where it is most needed. Right now it is estimated that the cost for that program would be about $467 per day with travel. Now, we looked into those estimates, dug in, and found that basically the $101 increase that we're seeing here is really due to the fact that the contract will be a federal contract, and so the $101 are really the differences between FLSA and SCA contracting rules as opposed to the private contract rules that are out there now. The $467 estimate that they have for this restructured program doesn't take into account any of the increased numbers of land days or any of the other factors that are likely to increase the costs when you start having an observer program on smaller boats that are fishing less frequently. Remember that 82% of the costs of the observers in the Alaska fishery right now are on very large boats. Catcher processors all have 100% coverage, and many of the trips are weeks long at a time. So when we went in and estimated those costs, and we are projecting that actually they'll probably be more like $525 per sea day plus travel. So that ends up being actually quite a bit closer to the costs that we're seeing here. We also looked at the West Coast Catch Share Program. In the West Coast, they've implemented IFQs in the fishery for the first time in 2011. This is IFQs in the shore-based trawl fishery. They have required 100% observer coverage on all IFQ trips. Previous coverage was estimated at about 20%. NIMS is currently reimbursing coverage on a sliding scale through 2013 to help transition to the point in 2014 when all the vessels will have to pay for this coverage. NIMS set the baseline level at $365 per sea day, and that's the amount that they would reimburse upon. They used that number, and it was a number that was taken basically from the Alaska costs. Costs in the West Coast right now for their existing program had been about $450 per day. Anyway, they figured that with 100% coverage, those costs should come down. Over time, the amount that is reimbursed by NIMS decreases from 90% this year down to 50% next year and 25% in 2013. The program also, I should note, has catch monitors that are similar to the dockside monitors that we have here in New England. I already mentioned the $365 was based on Alaska rates. Previous rates were $450. The vessel owners in the West Coast will contract directly with the providers, so they don't have the federal contracting rules, and that is one reason that the costs can be a little bit lower. What we found, and the program has only been operating for 9 months now, so the data are pretty sparse. We don't have really very good data. The fishery is very much in flux because it has been a pretty significant change. But what we found is that fishermen are very unsure of when to go fishing, how to go fishing, and so the patterns that we expect to see of fishing patterns aren't really coming out. We don't really know the way that it's going to play out, and that has made it very difficult for the providers that are providing observer coverage to have enough observers on hand to be able to run a profitable business. And my conversations with those providers are saying that they On the one hand, they're saying they don't think that they can continue to make ends meet at $365 per day, although one provider that I spoke with said that once those fishing patterns stabilize, we're able to be relatively sure when folks will be fishing, that we can make our hiring plans and make the number of observers that we have available fit the pattern. They really stress that they have a peak load issue, and that's utility talk. You have to have enough employees on hand to be able to cover the demand that is happening when, say, a beautiful, calm, clear day approaches and everybody wants to go fishing. If everybody in the fleet goes out one day, then you have to have enough observers to be on every boat. If there are 500 boats, you've got to have 500 observers. If everybody stays in on a bad weather day, you've still got to pay your observers. Otherwise, they're going to quit. You don't pay them as much. You pay them less. You pay them for half a day. But you've got to pay for those land days as well as the sea days. And that's that peak load issue and not having stable, steady numbers of trips is one of the things that has really been talked about in that fishery as a problem. I've talked a little bit about the federal cost contract, the FLSA, the Fair Labor Standards Act, and the SCA, the Service Contract Act. We estimated those are adding about $100 per day to observer costs in Alaska and are likely to would add under the restructured program. And that's just based on the wages that we that they're going to have to pay compared with what the wages they are paying. Right now, the ASM program in New England is a federal contract, but when it shifts to sectors in 2012, we would expect it to not be a federal program, that the contracts would be directly with the individual sectors. And so that then could reduce the wages and benefits that providers are paying their observers. Of course, observers may not think that that's a very good idea. Why would I say, well, I'd be perfectly happy to take a pay cut and continue to work in this job? May not happen. So what we are expecting is that there would have to be some turnover of ASMs, dockside monitors, when that happens in 2012 in order to get that wage level back down to that $100 savings. We should also point out that in the past, NEFOP has not reimbursed providers for their training costs when they weren't under federal contracts. And so that you probably can expect that providers will amortize the training costs of new observers into their C-Day costs. So that might push against the lower wages that we might expect when it goes into a private contract. We talk about in our document the issue of minimum size standards, retention, where it's you're required to discard, and we talk about that as it relates to at-sea monitors. A major goal of the at-sea monitoring program is to estimate discards, and because we have the minimum size standards, we have a fair amount of discards. We estimated, based again on industry averages, that there are about 1.9 million pounds of discards in the sector-based fisheries at $4.3 million then. At-sea monitors are costing about $2.20 per pound for each pound of discards. Now, that's kind of a flaky estimate, of course, but really since that the primary goal of observers or at-sea monitors is to look at discards. A fish that comes in can be measured and weighed at the beach. You don't have to. There's less uncertainty about that. Of course, they could go deliver somewhere else, and it may not be recorded and all that. Anyway, if there were fewer discards, then the uncertainty around the discard amount is reduced. And since discards count against each sector's ACE, there still would be incentives to land all of the fish, even if those prices might be pretty low. A small cod is not worth as much as a large cod. And we're saying that if there are no biological imperatives for discards, it might be prudent to re-examine the discard regulations that you have in place right now. Now, there may be discard, there may be good reasons to do that, and we're not suggesting that you throw out all science. I'm not a science, I'm a scientist, I'm an economist, so I don't know that, I don't know what those reasonings are. We also talk about ways that sectors in 2012, when they are going to take over the program, how they might be able to reduce their costs. As I mentioned earlier, the providers have to pay wages to their ASMs, generally, to keep them employed even when they are not out at sea. And so the land day costs are a significant part of providers' overheads. And so if you can reduce the number of land days relative to the number of coverage days, then your costs overall are going to be reduced. And so sectors can reduce their costs by increasing the amount of coordination that they have among their vessels and even perhaps among each of them, each of the sectors. If the number, for example, if the number of boats leaving a port each day is relatively stable, then it's relatively easy to figure out how many observers you need to have on hand and to deploy them on a regular basis. But on the other hand, if the number of boats that are leaving a port wildly varies, 6 one day, 2 the next day, none for a week at a time, then you're going to have a lot more land days that the providers have to pay for, and that's going to drive up the costs that eventually get paid for by the fishermen. Of course, if you take longer trips, that's going to reduce the number of land days as well. Not all vessels are probably equipped to take longer trips, but that's obviously something that will help. Our other recommendations are that to allow private contracts between sectors and providers. In other words, don't make it be a federal contract. Let it be a contract where there isn't the federal the Fair Labor Standards Act and SCA. That's one suggestion. We also would consider changes to the minimum size recommendations. That seems like a reasonable thing to look at. That might reduce the overall uncertainty with respect to discards. It might reduce it, actually, if you really play it out, it might make it more feasible to have lower levels of coverage if you're trying to estimate a certain coefficient of variation. Finally, you could enhance fairness and equity by charging sectors a fixed percentage fee of ex-vessel revenues, like we talked about in the North Pacific program. And under this option, it actually flies in the face of allowing a private contract. You would probably have to have a federal contract with NEFOP, and they would continue to control the ASM deployments, but it wouldn't necessarily be equal across every boat and across every sector. I think that's my presentation for now. The presentation that I had has a final sheet in there that has some errata that in the document, relatively minor things, but I wanted you to note those things. Mr. Chairman, that's my presentation. If there are questions, I'd be happy to entertain them. I don't suppose I get a choice on whether I'll answer them or not, but
thank you very much for that presentation. I think you've made some great observations and given us certainly a lot to think about on this whole monitoring issue. I'd open it up to council members or
I had a question of whether you looked at the average cost of the fish being landed on the West Coast versus what it might be on the East Coast, knowing that the biomass on fish such as the pollock or the cod is so much greater, so perhaps there's more room to layer in costs on West Coast species.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we made those estimates. I don't have them right in hand. They are included in the document. For the large boats, a lot of those in the Alaska fishery, a lot of those vessels are catcher processors, and catcher processors catch their fish, then process them into final products like fillets and surimi, and they're frozen. They end up not having an X vessel revenue, but they're selling directly into wholesale markets. So their revenue per pound of fish caught is really quite high. It's the final product value. Let's put it this way, that they're much better off at $323 per deployed sea day than they would be at 1.25% of X vessel revenue. It's a better deal for them to stay there. 1.25 would be an increase for them. So there, and that was one of the reasons that the program was split. The boats that have a coverage at 100% are going to continue in the daily fee program. But it is that level, 1%, 0.5%. In the West Coast fishery, again, it's early days in that fishery. We don't really have a full set of estimates. I think that we had a number in here that was something on the order of 8 or 9% of X vessel revenue. But again, it was only based on half a year and really very preliminary. But I would expect that to be in that ballpark. The fishermen in the West Coast right now are not paying for that. It's 90% is being paid for NIMS. That it is causing a lot of concern in the West Coast among the fishermen about how they will end up paying for those observers once they have to start.
So you're saying that the most cost-effective business plan is to be a processor, a vertically integrated catching processing vehicle, and those are the types of consolidated, vertically integrated business plans that work to cover observer costs the best, in your estimation.
Well, I'm not necessarily.
I'm just wondering if I need to change my business plan.
Yeah, you might want to change that, even among the pollock catcher vessels that have 100% coverage, those boats are catching an awful lot of fish, and their observer costs relative to revenue is still below 1%. But these guys are bringing back 200-300 tons a trip. In a 3-day trip, and at 10 cents a pound, you can see that their costs, $323 per day is not that big of a deal for them.
Jim Hodlin.
Yes, sir. Very interesting report. One thing for sure is 5% in this fishery is we can't afford it. I mean, it's the fisheries doesn't have that kind of profit margin in it. But I think there's a typo on your what to do with it. I lost it. It was when you mentioned that the observers were going to be required in 2014. Okay, it's on page 3. Nope, not page 3. Sorry.
Of the presentation?
I can't find it now. Just had it.
Yeah, I admit that I had I was getting my numbers confused there. It is 2014 that the sectors will be paying for those, and that I apologize.
We're required to pay it in 2012.
12, I mean. I
right.
Yeah.
And I think you had the numbers reversed and that you thought, and then you made a statement that it should be changed to 2012. I think you had it reversed.
Right.
You know it's required in 12, and you think it should be required in 2014.
I wasn't trying to imply that.
I can't find it. What the hell did I do with it?
I wasn't. Let me flip to it. I thought I had made that correction here. Let's see here. I'm not sure. I don't have the presentation in front of me here.
Yeah, it's on page 7, and it was your section 5.4. My comment is that it indicates that the at-sea monitoring costs will be paid by sectors starting in 2014.
Correct, yeah.
That should be 2012.
Correct, yeah.
And then the next bullet says it should be changed to, says 2012, and I think you meant 2014.
And that again was, I should change that bullet to 2012, not a recommendation that that was an internal comment that got incorporated into the document by mistake. I'm not implying there.
You're not making an opinion on that.
No, either. I'm not.
Right.
No,
I
apologize for that. And that was simply a correction that didn't happen.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. This question's already been asked in a different way, but I'll ask it again. When you did analysis, there was a lot of analysis about what it cost per day per coast. Okay, was there any analysis on percentage of net revenue? Because I think in a lot of cases on this coast, you'd probably come up with negative numbers. Thank you.
Net revenue at the fisher level, correct?
Per boat level.
Per boat. I wouldn't be surprised if there were negative numbers, particularly on days where the observer was being carried. We didn't have that level of detail for this analysis to undertake that study. I do think that a net revenue analysis is always better than a total gross revenue analysis. We didn't have those numbers available to us. And it would be something that we would recommend for sure.
Yeah, was this report produced just for us, or who else is going to see it?
This report was produced at the request of Environmental Defense Fund for the council here. When we're done with it, and we've corrected the errors, as fellow chairman or vice chairman Odlin suggested, then that will be up to EDF to distribute as they determine.
Thank you.
Dr. Pierce.
Yes, thank you for your presentation. On page 5 of the handout, you have that table showing a comparison of the at-sea monitoring costs to revenues. You've got it broken down by trip length classes, days in the class, coverage in class. Just need to check on something regarding an interpretation I have from this table and an extrapolation that I'm making. See if you think my extrapolation is valid. For the smaller vessels that take one trip, one day or one and a half day, the first class one, about 7,500 days in the class, and coverage was, of course, not 100%. You've got 1,976 days listed there. Then, of course, you show that cost as a percent of revenue is 9.9%. Now, that's gross revenue, right?
That's gross revenue, in the multi-species, of multi-species fish.
Okay, good. Now, I'm assuming, therefore, that if those vessels were required to have, let's say, 100% observer coverage, we can then just do some extrapolation here, and I'm roughly guessing now that for that particular class of vessels, the small vessels, one-day trips or one-and-a-half-day trips, costs, observer at-sea monitoring costs as a percent of revenue would be around 40%. And that's, again, gross revenue, not net revenue. So if we look at net revenue, the cost could go way above 40%. And similarly, if I look at class 2, 1.5 days to 3 days as a trip length going across that row. Once again, assuming 100% observer coverage, then it would go up from 5.2 to around 20% and probably higher than that if we consider net revenue. So those are the kind of on the fly estimations I'm making regarding what these data suggest for at-sea monitoring costs as a percent of revenue for the smaller vessels if we had 100% observer coverage. Does that sound reasonable to you, reasonable assumptions?
Mr. Chairman, it sounds if you want to calculate that, yes, you would divide the you multiply by whatever coverage you had in the sector up to 100% and then use that same to calculate.
This is very, very helpful. This is bound to have your work, your analyses are bound to have a very significant effect on this continued discussions as to the costs that the ground fish fleet will have to incur for at-sea monitoring. And, of course, 2012, as indicated earlier on, is fast upon us, and the implications are quite dramatic. Thank you.
Next, I have Paul Howard, then Doug Grout, David Gaithel, and Tom Tempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Marcus, on the slide that shows the North Pacific groundfish, they do not require observers on any vessels less than 60 feet. So what percent of the fleet is less than 60 feet, and what percent of the catch is caught from vessels less than 60 feet? That's one question. And the other one is on the Pacific Council's new groundfish IFQ. Are there any IFQ permit holders of any particular length that are not required to carry an observer in their
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Howard, answering your second question first because it's easy. If you are participating in the IFQ fishery, then you need to have 100% coverage. There are boats that there are fixed gear vessels, longline vessels that are buying trawl IFQ permits, and that's allowed. And those trawl or the fixed gear vessels that are fishing in the IFQ are fishing the IFQ permits, those also have to have 100% coverage. With respect to your earlier question, I didn't have the data in the presentation, but I believe I have it in the document, and I'm trying to thumb through it here. The numbers of vessels that are participating in the North Pacific fishery in the groundfish and halibut fishery that are less than 60 feet are actually considerably higher than the numbers of vessels that are greater than 60 feet. There's a lot of small boats that participate, and they're fishing longline gear, they're fishing pot gear, they're fishing in the IFQ halibut fishery. There's a lot of boats, in the thousands, I believe. The boats that are larger than 60 feet number in the a couple of hundred boats. And again, that's just approximate. There's a table in the document on page 20, on page 69 of the document itself, table 22, that breaks down a lot of that information. for example, in the halibut IFQ catcher vessel fleet, there are 1,351 boats. They actually had a few days of observer coverage because of their harvesting of groundfish, but most of those boats are not right now subject to observer coverage at all. There are, if you go through that table, you can see that there are really quite a few boats that are in the less than 100% coverage now. I don't have an estimate in the document that talks about how much ex-vessel revenue they generate, but it's relatively small.
My question was, the majority of our fleet is less than 60 feet. What percent of the North Pacific Council fleet that's less than, what percent of the catch is that representative of that don't have observers? 10%, 5%? It must be very small, otherwise they'd have an observer.
It is relatively small in terms of total pounds. It actually can be a much larger percent of total revenue because the fish that those smaller boats are targeting end up being halibut and black cod, and both of those species are very high value. Black cod is $6-$7 a pound ex vessel. Halibut is sometimes $5-$6 a pound ex vessel. I'm afraid that my data, I don't have that information in front of me, so I can't provide an exact number. But it isn't the majority by any means. It's less than much. I would say much less than 50% of the total revenue.
Doug Grout.
Thank you very much. This is a good report and very informative. My question for you is concerning the fees that are charged in the North Pacific Groundfish Observer Program on page 5. Who collects those fees, and then who ends up dispersing those fees to the observer program? And if, well, answer that question, and then I'll have a follow-up.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Grout, in the restructured program, where the percentage fees will be collected, those will actually be paid to NIMS by the buyers. So they'll pay the vessel's share and their own share directly into accounts that go to National Marine Fisheries Service. That's under the restructured program, okay? The current program, the observers are paid by the owners directly, or the observer providers are paid directly.
So under the new program, NIMS is being paid by the dealers or buyers, both the vessel share and the dealer share, correct? Is that what you mean?
That's my understanding of the way the system will work. It's not in place yet, and they haven't worked out all of the ins and outs of that.
And I don't know if you can answer this or anybody else from the service, but I'd love to get this piece of information. Is this something that needed to be put in place via federal rules? Is it part of the management plan?
Yes, this was all part of the groundfish fishery management plan and part of the halibut plan. It was a full amendment with a full, I believe it was an EA, but there was the full regular full process that it went through, public testimony, scoping, the whole works.
Thank you.
David Gatham.
Yeah. Thank you. I got some questions in, some comments. First of all, I'd say I think your report exposed the huge inequities that already exist in this program in the first year. I'm from the smallest sector with the least fish, and I had the highest percentage of coverage. So on a pounds, dollars per pound or whatever you want to call it landed, you know, if we'd have been paying for this, we would have paid ridiculously in excess of what we should be on a percentage basis. The second thing I would point out to the council is once you shift these costs over, one of our goals and objectives in Amendment 16 was to preserve the day boat fleet. You're not going to do it. You're going to exterminate the day boat fleet. So we're not meeting one of our goals and objectives right at the moment. As was shown in your report, the costs fall disproportionately on the day boats. And if you actually broke that down on an hourly basis, it would fall even worse, because a lot of those trips aren't even a full day. And yet, I need to find this out from somebody. I don't know if you have the information, but that charge that they charge for an observer, I think you pay the same whether you're gone for 24 hours or 24 minutes. So there's the observer companies have a huge incentive to get people on boats that only go out for 5 or 6 hours, because then they're you know, the observer who gets a fixed fee, a fixed amount of dollars, in essence goes from making maybe $10 an hour to making $50 an hour from their chunk of the fee. So there's a lot of things being exposed in this report. The last thing I'd like to say is, I think you should provide some more information on the differences between the West Coast and the East Coast. We are predominantly a small boat fleet on the East Coast. And a lot of the suggestions you make are basically undoable here. Sectors can reduce costs by increasing coordination. Well, day boats can only go when the weather's good. They can't, you know, they can't say, all right, three of you go today, and, oh, yeah, the wind's blowing 40 tomorrow. Three more of you go out there when it's blowing 40. It doesn't work that way. We're going to go when we can go. And so that suggestion, at least for day boats, is unreasonable. The second one on take longer trips, we're day boats. We're day boats for a reason. I'm a 40-foot boat. The boat only holds so much. It can only go to sea for so long. It can only carry so much ice. It wasn't built to make multiple day trips. It was built to be a day boat. So, you know, I think we, you know, you really should provide some caveats here or some further explanations, because people are going to pick this report up and they're going to run with it. And you know, people who want to promote the program are going to say, well, here's all you got to do. You can get the cost down to under 4%. And I give you an example from the government's report that we just received, report for fishing year 2010 on the performance of Northeast multi-species groundfish fishery. So you can get some of the numbers out of this to help you flesh this out a little bit more. The 30 to 50-foot vessel size category also contains the largest number of active groundfish vessels. And it goes on to say, but they've experienced a 30% reduction from 351 to 246 with this program. And that's without paying for the observers. So I think, you know, really need to provide some more information here, because I'm afraid people will get a distorted picture otherwise, that all we got to do is be like the West Coast and everything will be fine. And we can't be. You know, we're not, you know, my 40-footer isn't going to turn into a catcher processor, no matter how much I squint at it and hope that it does. It's not happening. So we have to get a program on this coast that will work for this fishery. And if we don't, then we're going to have to do away with the program.
Tom, you're all set? Or did you?
I'm all set. If we're done with this conversation, I'd like to introduce a motion, but I'll wait till Marcus is done.
Let me go to a couple more, and then I'll come back to you. I've got Rick Robbins then Jim Odlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had the same question about collection that's already been asked, but I wanted to follow up and ask, what level of coverage under the newly restructured North Pacific program, what level of coverage is that expected to translate into across those fleets?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Robbins, They were hoping to get up to around 30%, but I don't think they were in the document that they prepared. There were certain levels of caveats that they put in. I don't think they got the fee that they were hoping to get originally, that they were thinking that it had 30%. And I think, as I mentioned, that we believe that the daily charges will end up being higher than 467, and so that they would even get less. I really don't have a good number, but it's probably less than 30%. My conversations with the observer program people, they They indicated to me that they are happy to be able to put the observers where they believe they're getting the most bang for the buck, and that's their intention, and that they'll work within the funding that they have to do so. Could they use more? Yes. But they believe that the flexibility that they have is an improvement.
If I may follow up, Mr. Chairman, what is the council's role then in on an ongoing basis in trying to prioritize the coverage? Does the council maintain an active role under the newly restructured program in determining where observer coverage is focused?
Mr. Chairman, again, the restructured program has not been put into place. I guess the short answer would probably be that the council does not have a direct role in telling NIMS where to put coverage. NIMS will put coverage where they believe it is most important. I believe that the council's role, and again, I'm speaking just from my experience with the council and with NIMS in the North Pacific, not as a spokesman for either. The council has a role, ends up kind of directing where coverage goes through some of their programs and some of the issues that they're discussing. For example, an issue might come up that says, boy, we don't have any idea how much salmon is being harvested by this group of boats out here, and we see that that's a problem. And so they bring up this conversation. The conversation happens. People are discussing it. Then that leads National Marine Fisheries Service to say, well, yes, we need to answer that question. And so they may end up increasing the amount of coverage in that segment of the fleet. Right now, they're kind of limited on the existing program. Their coverage is 30% by boats that are less than 60 or greater than 60 feet and less than 125. And the coverage days end up being determined largely by the vessels themselves. So it is certainly viewed as an improvement under the restructured program.
I have Jim and then Mary Beth, and then I'm going to move over to Tom for a motion.
Yeah, I just had a question, and I know you've just sourced data, but on page 5, and it doesn't change your percentages or your cost of the program, but it says that the fleet used 25,167 days. And we have a report from the performance of the fisheries from Drew Kitts and his company, that his group, that we only used 18,000. And I don't like seeing discrepancies like that. I'm wondering what happened.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We did have some issues with the data that we were getting and had available to us. I believe the last set of data that we had numbers of trips by NIFOs plus ASMs, and we used a previous iteration of data that had the numbers of trips and the numbers of days, and so we assumed that even though the total data set changed in some ways, that the ratio of trips to days had stayed constant. So there is certainly room in our report. We use the data, I guess, fully, you might say, we inferenced and implied from the data that we had, I guess.
Yeah. Thank you. It doesn't change your percentages of the cost, I don't believe, but I just wanted to see that and ask why. So thank you for that.
Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for that report. And unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to read through it all, so I was just getting a little confused, and I think I found the source of part of my confusion. I was reading the problem statement for the restructured program, which is the program prior to what it is now. But anyway, I do work for a company that has three vessels operating under Amendment 80 in the Bering Sea. Mm-hmm. And as I look through some of this information, I mean, I think that some of the information provided is pre-restructuring and then post-restructuring. And as you said, the restructured program is not yet implemented. But my understanding was that restructuring, the 30% vessels were the 60 to 125 for most, unless you're in a program like Amendment 80 and then it's two observers on all boats, but that the new restructured program only exempts vessels under 45 feet. And the council was trying to have it work that way because, open cockpit halibut vessels, clearly that they identified that as a problem, but that their goal was to get 30% across all other fleets, all other vessels greater than 45 feet. Is that right, do you think?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lee, I guess I'm not aware of the – I didn't see anything in there about a 45-foot limit, and that may be my fault that I didn't see that. I'm not – it doesn't seem to me to have – I didn't see it in the motion. I'll certainly check on that. You are correct, though, that the boats that had 100% coverage or more, like the Amendment 80 fleet, would not be part of that program.
Yeah, and I'm not positive, but I mean, I did listen to the council's deliberations when they chose final alternatives, and that's the way I recall, but I can't find it. I don't know if I'm right or if I'm wrong, but that is the way I remember the discussion, that just the under 45 feet were exempt.
And the motion that I reviewed, I just don't remember seeing that. I certainly didn't write about it that way. And that, could very well be the case. But I didn't. It wasn't part of what I saw that I recall.
Yeah, if I find it, I'll share it with you. I haven't found it either. But
I can look through it and find out as well.
Yeah, and the other thing, Rick asked a question about the role of the council and in watching that amendment progress. The primary role that the council had in that was they had a lot of analysis in front of them of what the different percentages would mean for target coverage levels and the economic impact to the industry that they could have and the authority to actually tax the industry for this program was through an amendment to Magnuson. And so I didn't know if you had any reference to that here. I mean, that's a limiting factor that we don't have that ability to do that. So the council can set a percentage up to 3%. They can adjust it over time, and the percentage of 1.25 was a choice the council made that they can change in the future.
That seems like that's correct, I believe. Your last statement there.
Yeah. So to me, that's their primary role, their ability to have influence on what the output is.
I believe that they would have to have a new process if they want to change that fee. They don't just, we want to change it. It's a whole another amendment process to change it now that it's in the amendment. And it may very well be that the authority to be able to get that fee may be through the North Pacific Research Plan amendment that is part of Magnuson-Stevens Act.
I have had a request for two more before Tom, Patton and Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I haven't had a chance to read the report either. In fact, we just received the report late last week, and so we haven't had an opportunity to really look at the numbers and compare them to numbers that we've generated for the same kind of information. So I'm very uncomfortable with some of the results of the report, frankly. And I would just point out that, for example, for 2011, we've estimated the ATSI monitoring cost for the sectors anyway to be somewhere between $2 and $2.5 million, significantly less than $4.3 million, and that's of course not, that does not include any kind of changes in the cost that might result from people negotiating those contracts themselves. So I just caution the council that this data is very difficult to use, and I'm not at all surprised that there's a difference in the numbers of days, for example. We sometimes have differences in the number of days we look at between the regional office and the science center because the data is so complicated, and you really have to be an expert to know how to use it.
Right. Thanks, Rip. I do appreciate also appreciate your report, and I think it points out, and I also want to acknowledge the tremendous Herculean effort that Amy and her staff went through to stand up this huge program, ASMs. I think aside from the comments that Pat just made about some of the data, I had some of the same issues with some of the data analyses that were shown, but I think that this report does, in fact, provide some evidence to dispel some of the myths that have been abounding on the on this coast about how expensive our at-sea monitoring and NEFOP program is compared to the West Coast. I think when you look at things overall, the subsidies and the extraordinary flexibility that our industry has, and the deployment costs that we incur, and the training costs that we incur, that the cost between the ASMs and full observers that we have on the East Coast, when you don't compare apples to oranges, when you try to get it apples to apples, that the differences in costs are actually quite minimal. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have a comment?
Mr. Chairman, I would also like to add my thanks to Frank mentioned the efforts that Amy and her staff have put together. They were very helpful in helping us work through the numbers, and I did want to make sure that I acknowledged her efforts in providing us information in a timely manner, and hope that it doesn't come across that we're pounding on her. She really was very forthright, and we couldn't have provided the information that we did provide without a lot of help from her and from NIMS staff in the region. So,
I had no intent to infer that. No. Anything other than that.
I didn't take it that way. So.
Thank you very much, Marcus. Tom.
Sorry. Thanks for that. And I guess what I'm taking away from this presentation, I think it was a very helpful one, and it's sort of my nature to view the glass as half full, and I think there's some important lessons that there are ways to control costs. Some of the takeaways are use ATSI monitors wherever possible, target deployment to meet FMP goals, minimize paid land days for ATSI monitors, transition to electronic monitoring wherever feasible, and distinguish ATSI costs from infrastructure costs, and identify in writing where that line is and who's responsible for what. I think the issue of monitoring this fishery is a problem, obviously, that we can't overstate. I don't think, as it's structured now, as the program is now, the industry can afford to pay this. I also don't think we can afford not to have comprehensive monitoring. So with that, I was going to put up a motion. Move that the council initiate a groundfish framework action to address issues regarding the continued implementation and funding of cost-effective and comprehensive catch monitoring in the sector program. These measures would be part of the framework to adjust sector rules that is being considered for management priorities in 2012.
Is there a second? Laura. Discussion. Jim.
So I just want to ask the maker of the motion, if we adopt this motion, then we will take the information that we get from the sector workshop, and that will be the same framework. You're not saying this is the first action of the framework. You're just saying that you want this to be part of the framework that we develop this will be part of that framework that we're going to develop with the information to make sectors run better and try to implement it as soon as we can. Right. Is that the intent?
Yeah, the intent is to initiate it. We discussed yesterday under the priorities discussion some of the timing issues, and that if at all possible, we'd like to get this in place for the start of the fishing year 2012. So the intent is to initiate a framework action that would then very likely incorporate some of the fixes that were coming out of the workshop and sort of keep it moving forward and get it on the water.
I guess my question will have to go to Gene. If we initiate a framework today under this, then can we add the other stuff that we're going to do later? I'm just confused with the mechanics. That's all about initiating a framework. Initiating a framework is a formal term, right? That today's the first day, and then you're...
Well, I think it's only relevant if you're trying to do something in two council meetings, for example. Once, if it looks like it's going to take longer than that, then you can broaden the scope of the framework. I would say you should make it clear sooner rather than later as to what the scope of this framework is or how it will fit into the types of actions that you're talking about.
Yes, Tom.
Yeah, I just want to make sure I understand something that's not said in the motion but was said at the table. The hope that these measures would be in place by May 1st, 2012? I mean, I think council members need to recognize that that's an impossibility at this stage. We don't have the sector workshop until the third week of October, so we won't even have identified any of the things from the sector workshop, which means, we're still trying to finish up Framework 47 and some of the other things. So, I mean, if the expectation is this is going to be in place by May 1st of 2012, I think that's completely unrealistic at this stage.
Tom.
Yeah, I apologize. I guess I misspoke. What I meant to say is as close to the start of the 2012 fishing year as feasible, and I think initiating this action today gives us the flexibility to achieve that.
So to be clear on Jim's question, are you thinking that this is initiating the framework today or once we get the sector workshop material?
My intention was to initiate, at least formally, a framework today to deal with some of these monitoring issues. If there's a better idea, if it makes sense for us to bind that or to incorporate that, then I'm willing to have that conversation. But my intent is to deal with these monitoring issues as quickly as possible and get them on the water as quickly as possible. However, I'm open to ideas as to how best to frame that so that the council can get that done.
Well, I'm not going to put words in Tom's mouth, but I think what he was saying, I mean, you can initiate it today. I'm not sure that initiating it today or sometimes, subsequent to the sector workshop, doing it today is necessarily going to get it out the door substantially faster. But, Tom?
Well, I think that's the case. I guess... Without concluding how the council is going to vote in November on priorities, I would just ask that you consider that right now we've got four things that you've said are the first priority for fishing year 2012, and they're not all going to happen at once. You've got the ABC finishing up, well, three things, I guess, finishing up Framework 47, addressing the ABCs early, perhaps, if necessary, proceeding with the groundfish closed areas, trying to figure out adjustments for achieving OI, and now this. So I think council members are going to have to be prepared in November to decide which one of these priorities they really want to pursue first.
Further, Laura.
But isn't that the basis of the, Mr. Chairman, the basis of the priorities conversation? And if we don't have this on the list, then it won't be part of the conversation.
Mark Gibson.
Mr. Chairman, I don't see how you can do this without the visioning amendment. It seems to me that the cost effectiveness, the scientific comprehensiveness, the affordability is going to pivot on what your vision of the groundfish fleet is. And if your vision is for a lot of boats of different sizes and geographically diverse ports, that's going to be a formidable sampling problem in addition to a formidable affordability problem. If your vision is at the other extreme, where a couple of large vertically integrated processes or whatever the terms were, that's a pretty easy sampling problem, and it's a pretty affordable problem because of the money they make. So without that visioning exercise, I don't see where this goes. I think you have to have the vision inside of what your fleet's going to look like before you can figure out how to sample it and pay for it.
Dave Cato.
I think Mark's right. The problem is we're between a rock and a hard place here. If we don't initiate a framework today, then we can't possibly have it in place by May 1st. That was what Pat said at the beginning of the meeting. And if we don't initiate it today and we don't have something in place by May 1st and Congress doesn't come through, then most of us can't go fishing on May 2nd. So, you know, something has to happen sooner rather than later. And there's a lot of us that can't afford to wait. You know, I mean, if we knew for a fact that Congress was going to act, we wouldn't need the framework at all because we'd have a year to solve the problem. But we don't know that. What we do know, based on this report, is that there are a lot of us that can't leave the pier if we don't solve this monitoring issue between now and May 1st.
Pat.
Just to be clear about what I said you had to actually take final action on a framework in November. So I don't... You know, I think the argument has been that you can't initiate today and be ready to take final action in November. So,
further counts, Sally.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support this motion. I think it puts it in the context that we need to be considering it with other priorities. And at the same time highlights that something that is absolutely fundamental to the fishery. You know, I agree in a best-case scenario that we would have the fleet diversity and accumulation limits work done, but that's not going to get done as quickly as this needs to be in place. You know, monitoring is fundamental to quota compliance and to our understanding of the fishery. So I don't see how we don't do this and put this out there so that we are clearly saying that monitoring is a very high priority. At the same time, you know, by November we'll be sorting out what the other priorities are for the groundfish fishery. And I don't know if, I mean, I can only sympathize with staff on something like this, where the council is always adding things to the to-do list and always adding things to the number one priority list. But there's got to be a way to get this done, because if we don't, then we don't know what's going on in the fishery. And if we don't, then we're not going to be able to make any decisions moving forward. So I don't see this as chicken and an egg. I think this is the bottom line. Thanks.
I'm going to go to the audience comments. Jim and then Tina.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim Kendall, New Bedford Seaport Consulting. What's currently on my list here right now is the differences basically between the Pacific fisheries and the East Coast fisheries. And I didn't get a sense of how many days they are currently using at sea or at the dock, and yet they have two billable costs, one for at-sea costs and one for a day at the dock. Well, if we look around and start to figure out what the possible ramifications could be for, say, our groundfish fleet with 30 or 40 days at sea, if they're lucky, and the day site cost, or cost per day at the dock site, you're looking nearly at 10 to 1 on the days at sea versus the at the dock site, and how would you adjust costs for that? And it seemed like there was like a 50% cost for their days at sea to their dock site day. So that, to me, that's pretty troubling considering the amount of time these boats spend at the dock. If you look and use the scallop industry right now, based on their cost, I just checked with Harriet Diedrichson, she says it's about $800 a day. If they start to tie that in a similar fashion at some point in time to the scallop industry, I can't begin to imagine how that would have to be adjusted. And if you start tying it into the value of the cost, like David said earlier, it would be, you know, unbearable for the small boats to try and pay off fees like that. I really think you need some additional work on this, so that I'm hopeful, and I don't believe that this could go through as initiating a framework today to have it in place by May, because I think you've got a lot more to look at than what we've currently seen. Thank you.
Tina?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First and foremost, it becomes a little perplexing as to why the fleet should be responsible for the government's data collection and management of a program that nobody wanted anyway. But I wanted to bring to the Council's attention in Magnuson 303A, 97453 and 104297, the establishment of fees. And I know that the interpretation of some of this is going to be that it's strictly limited access privilege. But there is a portion in here in paragraph 2 that specifically states community development quota program that allocates a percentage of the total allowable catch of a fishery to such a program, which would be 98% to the sectors and 2% to the common pool. Fees shall not exceed 3% of the X vessel of fish harvested under any such program. And I know that a lot of that is based on interpretation, but as I read that, my interpretation is just that. It's a community-based program with a percentage of the catch allocated to a particular group. I mean, not only does and I'm going to elaborate a little bit more as to what David was saying for the day boats, because obviously, I mean, I'm common pool, but, you know, my membership, a lot of my membership is specifically sector. And not only does each boat have to pay their sector fee each year, which is roughly about, what, $2,500 on average. I think that's per boat, per permit. But a lot of them are having to pay for membership to the organizations that are running the sector. So that's kind of like a double hit right there. They're paying a percentage of what they're landing to continue to run the sector throughout the course of the year. And now we're going to have the added cost of at-sea monitors, which, you know, $900 to $1,400 roughly on estimate. I know these are all guesstimates at this point. Plus the cost of buying allocation. I mean, these are the real issues at hand here that this council seriously, seriously needs to understand. And I'm sure you're taking it very seriously in a sense, but, you know, try to really come to the conclusion that we can't do this. The fleet cannot pay for at-sea monitors or dockside monitors. We just can't do it. And consider the fact that really by law, in my interpretation of it, the council cannot ask the boats to pay any more than 3%. And based on what's here, it's looked like they're asking, you know, 8 to 10% according to some of the charts here. So that really needs to be taken into consideration. And I do fully support what's up on the board right now. The sooner we get it done, as David was saying, the better off we are. There's got to be a way that the government can come in, or this council can find a way to pay for this. This is really the government's job. This is not the boat's responsibility to pay for government data collection and or management of this program. And I understand that also it's being talked about, too, that common pool and the recreational and charter sector are going to be asked to start taking at-sea monitors and possibly paying for dockside monitors as well sometime in the near future, possibly by 2014. I mean, that's another issue that's going to be coming up that, again, the fleets just cannot afford to pay for. So I just wanted to get that particular portion of Magnuson Law on the record, and that the council series needs to take a look at that section 303A in Magnuson and consider where the law states 3%. So thank you.
Is there anyone who wishes to speak against this? For?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ben Martens from the Mid-Coast Fishermen's Association and also the Port Clyde Community Groundfish Sector. And I would just like to speak strongly in favor of this motion. We've got a lot of problems that are in the sector management right now that can be fixed, and we need to look at those. Monitoring is definitely one of them. There's some things that we can do, some adjustments that can be made, and we need to put this framework in place so that we can do it. Booting this down, I think, would really put a lot of the small boat sectors at risk, and we need to take this step today to move this forward. Thank you.
I'm going to go against and for. Against? For, Aaron?
Aaron Doherty, Northeast Coastal Community Sector. So I'm also speaking in favor of it. However, I think that we need to recognize that we probably need both a combination of a short-term and a long-term fix. And if this isn't going to be ready by May 1, then we need to figure out something that will be ready by May 1, because as David Gaethel has pointed out, and as a number of other people have pointed out, we are really looking at a crisis here starting May 1. So we need a short-term fix as well. Thanks.
I'm going to bring it back to the council. Dr. Pierce.
Based upon some of the discussions I've heard so far, I was going to suggest that we insert equitable into the list of cost-effective, comprehensive, and equitable, but I think cost-effective embraces the equity issue, small boats versus large boats, for example. I'll support this motion if for no other reason than it will oblige the council to take another look at, a more focused look at whether or not what we have in place right now truly is cost-effective, and is it comprehensive? What defines cost-effective and comprehensive? I don't think right now it is cost-effective, and I don't believe it's comprehensive. So this will get us back into those discussions, and for that reason, I would favor supporting. I would vote in favor of the motion.
Anyone on the council opposed? I think we'll. Terry, and then Glenn.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not exactly comfortable with the language, but I'm 100% supportive of the concept. I think that we need to be crystal clear that there's no expectation that we're going to get this out the door in November. And to Aaron's point there, I mean, there's a short-term fix, and this is going to be part of a longer-term fix, because I would suspect it's going to be coupled together with the lessons learned from our sector workshop, and which we talked about in yesterday's or 2 days ago priority discussion. So I will support this measure.
Glenn.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief. Being a boat owner, I can guarantee you that a $700 a day tab is oftentimes going to exceed net revenue for the day. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to call the question. All those in favor of the motion, so indicate. Sixteen, opposed, abstention. 16-01, the motion carries. Is there anything else on this issue? Okay, let's take a 10-minute break. We'll come back and get the report from the Science Center and